session number 31509, Reel 10.
Gavin Douglas, Reel 10. If I could now go back, Gavin, to ask you about your experience as a squadron leader with the 34 Squadron. I believe you mentioned these were Thunderbolts, is that right?
That is correct. They were built by an American company called Republican, and they were known as the Republican P-47D, ours was Mark D, it was a later development of the Thunderbolt. They were designed actually for high-level fighters to accompany bombers on long trips and for bomber protection. We were short of all sorts of aircraft at that time, and this was part of America's leaseland. And the P-47s that came to us were used entirely for the wrong kind of job, which was ground attack. They weighed 7 tons, and they had what was called a very high wing loading, which meant that if you were going at speed and diving at a low altitude, they didn't pull out of a dive in the normal way. They would go on sinking like a brick. And even though you got the nose up above the horizon and you should be going round in a parabola and climbing up again, they just sank downwards, belly downwards. And the CO whom I replaced had done just that. He had been on a low bombing attack, Japanese positions, and he never pulled out of the dive. He was trying to. Everybody could see that he was, but the ground hit the Thunderbolt hit the ground with a terrific swack, and of course it rode him off and the plane and everything else. So we had to learn to operate them gently to pull them out of a dive. And so we had to let your bombs go a little bit higher than you would from a hurricane, otherwise you'd never get out in time. When I arrived at Sador, I had never seen a Thunderbolt before, and I had never even flown one. And I had to learn all the knobs and dials and everything on a dirt jungle. On a dirt strip in the jungle, aided, of course, by other pilots who had already converted on them. And the cockpit controls, or the dials, all those things are very, very much more complicated than in a Hurricane or a Spitfire. And there are an enormous number of them, and many more electrics in a Thunderbolt than there are in a British aircraft. However, you had to learn where all they were with your eyes shut or blindfolded, so that you could know where to find them automatically when you were flying, if the plane filled with cockpit filled with smoke or anything of that sort. And you wouldn't be handicapped by it. As far as flying was concerned, I was told they took an awful long run to get off the ground. And usually they were supposed to come off at about 140 miles an hour. But on dirt strips, even when there was perforated steel plate on the strip, you had to get more than 150 miles an hour, 150 knots. Using a nautical term, before the plane would really get unglued, except on very good dry days, which meant you had to have very long dirt strips bulldozed out of the jungle by the sappers. And I saw some horrendous takeoffs where the plane just would not come off the ground. It was going along at 115, it wouldn't climb. And my flight commander, Dave Williamson, one day, took off, when I was watching him do the takeoff, he was going to lead the section, that particular operation, and his plane didn't come off, and of course, beyond the dirt strip, the jungles had been cleared of trees for 100 or so yards, and he never got off the ground, and flew straight into this cleared area, and hit the trees. And I thought, oh my God, he must have had it. Well, I was extraordinarily surprised. We all dashed over. The Hurricane, a very robust aircraft, had broken quite a few teak trees, but at the same time, it was utterly damaged. And of all things, Dave Williamson was getting out of the cockpit and walked away without any injuries whatsoever. It was a miracle. However, That shows how difficult they were to fly at low altitudes. They weren't designed for low altitudes. They were designed for high altitude work. And they had a very long range. They could stay up for 5 hours, very good for escorting bombers on long trips. Whereas we wanted short trips and agile, mobile aircraft that could do the jobs quickly and come back quickly. Nevertheless, this is what we had, and we had to get on with it. Now, my return to Burma coincided almost immediately with the outset of the monsoon. We were able to do about 2 or 3 weeks of ground attack against Japanese positions before the monsoon really set in. And for days and days, we were grounded. The dirt strips became mud strips. Hello? Hello? Yes, speaking. I can't hear you. A little better.
And soon, won't you?
Yes. Well, in spite of that, we were able to carry out various attacks as ordered on Japanese positions at a much longer range than previously. You must remember that the Japanese were now on the run, and they were going south and getting out of Burma as quickly as they could, very much handicapped because they were short of food, they were sick and diseased, and one almost felt sorry for them. But that's war. And when they got down towards central south Burma, they were trying to cross over the mountains into Thailand, not going all the way down to Singapore, of course. Well, they were sitting targets. Whenever we got out, those who weren't dying of sickness from privation and everything else were very easy targets. And their spirits had completely gone. As far as we were concerned, of course, the tide had turned. Our morale was very, very high. And it was towards the middle of September when suddenly we heard that, I should say before that, taking these long flights at a higher altitude to wherever the target was, we often were flying in 10-tenths cloud. Cloud in Burma in the monsoon goes up to enormous heights. It'll go from the down on the deck up to 40,000-50,000 feet. And sometimes there were layers of clear air between the different layers of cloud. But often we were in cloud, and we always flew in a line abreast, and I asked everybody to close in, and so they could just see the person on their left or their right as we flew back, and they were all taking their lead from the leader, of course. And that way there was a certain amount of cohesiveness. Well, sometimes the cloud was so dense that you lost sight of the person on your left. You just had to glue your eyes on your instruments and fly on the instruments only, note your course, and keep going on that number of degrees. We had a new young pilot. He wasn't more than 19 years old, Flight Sergeant Neat. He'd only recently joined us. He'd done one or two practice trips with me, and he was on this particular flight. We were coming back. We went into this dense cloud, and when we came out of it the other side, his plane was missing. Days later, we found that he had got lost. He had panicked. He was young, inexperienced, and I think he got into a spin somehow, which he couldn't get out of, and his plane was found half buried in a paddy field. And of course, he was killed. And I had the unpleasant job, as I did several times after, for other people, writing to the next of kin to say that we had lost another pilot. And that was always a very tense and difficult job. As I said, we weren't flying anything like the number of hours that we flew before the monsoon. And suddenly we heard that the Japanese had surrendered. And we were so gung-ho at that time that it shocked us. We were doing so well, and in my squadron anyway, all the pilots and the ground crews suddenly felt as though the rug had been pulled out from under our feet. And we were, for about 48 hours, we all went around with our faces as long as our boots, feeling that we'd been robbed. Because we were all ready to go and fly across to the Chinese seaboard and start attacks on the Japanese islands. Of course, the Japanese, being what they were, would have put up a terrific struggle. What we didn't know then and what we realize now, there had been terrific casualties on our part had we had to do that. Well, flying was over, and we awaited orders. I was ordered to fly my squadron down to an airfield just outside Burma called Azayatquin, where I handed it over and immediately had posting orders to join a squadron I had been in before, the first squadron I ever joined in Burma, which was 28 squadron. 28, when I joined them, had Hurricane 2Bs. Now they had Spitfire 14s. And again...
Yes, would you have been a squadron leader at that?
Yes, I didn't drop my rank.
They posted me from
34 squadron, they posted me to 28 squadron.
Yes. I was going to ask you, about 34 being squadron leader, this is what you wanted. Was it a good thing to be a squadron leader? How did you take to that, the satisfaction of it? Was it what you wanted?
That's a difficult question to answer. It was promotion, which of course, and it was responsibility. And I was, having come in from the army, I had much more experience than most other people in handling men. And yes, I looked forward to it very much. I had first... I felt that I'd reached my goal, which is what I wanted, of course. And I wanted my squadron to be the best squadron there was. I mean, all the cliches and that sort of thing. But... it started off, of course, when I arrived in, to retract a little bit, to go back, rather. When I joined 60 Squadron, they had an excellent squadron with a wonderful record. But when I got there, all the pilots were young and disorganized and scruffy, and I felt didn't have any enjoyment out of flying, and the first thing I had to do as an ex-army officer was get them lined up and smartened up.
Yes, and you did actually describe all this.
I did, okay,
yes,
I'm sorry.
Yes, you gave a very good account
anyway,
of that.
Well, it was an extension of that when I became a squadron leader. I was no longer just looking after my flight and also the squadron, because the CO at the time was tired and the time expired. It was a continuation of that. I now had my own squadron. I was personally responsible, and it was my job to see the squadron did its job properly.
And before you go on to the post-war situation, I wonder if I could ask you a little bit more about Burma. And first of all, did you ever meet this group of women called the Wasbys?
Oh, yes, I'm so sorry. I should have mentioned them because they were marvellous.
Could you explain who they were for people who know nothing about these women?
Well, Women's Auxiliary Service Burma, WASB, is why they were called WASBs. They were, generally speaking, wives whose husbands were at war somewhere, either in the Middle East or in Burma, and they felt that they should do something for some war service themselves, and the WASBs were formed in India to provide the services that the British had elsewhere in the ATS and RENS and RINs, which up to that time we hadn't got in Burma. Their job, They did all sorts of things. They were in ciphers and other things. But there were those who were looking after us in frontline positions in Burma. And as an example, they used to drive around Army and Air Force units who were right up within very close range of Japanese troops in some kind of old converted truck that had been had stoves and cupboards in it and food, and they would visit us on an airstrip, and the first thing you knew was smell bacon being fried or something like that, and it was wonderful, because these women wore a uniform, of course, jungle green like everybody else. They looked like ordinary troops, but of course they were women. And they came up, and they not only visited us, I think, as I said, but also army units right up close to the Japanese. And seeing them with their trucks was wonderful for the morale. It made life seem so much more comfortable.
Yes, I suppose having a woman at the front.
Yes, well, I remember one day on a trip into central Burma, we were called over to this toasted bacon sandwiches that the lady was handing out, and to my surprise, I saw somebody that I recognized, actually the wife of one of the officers in my regiment, who Tony Sanger, who was not there, and I said, "Ara," which was her name, Ara Sanger. I said, "What in the world are you doing here?" And she said, "Oh, I've been with Wasbys for quite a time. A lot of us are doing this nowadays." And that was really my first experience of meeting a Wasby. Well, there were many of them, and they were doing these sort of wonderful morale trips for us. And but that was only one side of the Wasby action, because they were filling in all sorts. They were doing clerks, works of all the things that the ATS would be doing in England, only in much more difficult circumstances. After all, they were in the jungle with us. Where they went, where they slept, and all that, I have no idea. But they couldn't have been very far away, because they had to be within driving distance of, and not just one airstrip, but whatever and wherever we were.
The other thing I was going to ask you about was the, did you ever see or meet Mountbatten in Burma, or sort of know what he was doing there? Did you hear?
Oh, well, there was a very good newspaper that was put out called SEAC, Southeast Asia Command, and that gave us, it was good reading, and it gave us all the information about what other people were doing. I did meet Mountbatten. He came just after the war was over to present new colours to one of the Indian regiments, whose name I cannot remember, the big parade. He drove up, we were all paraded, the Air Force was there too. He drove up in a sedan or touring car, looking terrific. He had with him a gorgeous looking Wren, who was his driver, and he had learned to a speech in Urdu, and he got up and stood on the platform, a very commanding, very handsome figure. And of course, he in Urdu, he wrote out a congratulatory speech for the regiment in particular, whose colors were being presented, new colors were being presented. And he was in naval whites, full whites. And that was the first time I met him, anyway. I met him several times after the war, but that was another story.
Mm. Yeah. Do you think he was important to the Burma campaign? It's often referred to, isn't it, as the forgotten war, that, you know, it didn't make so much impact as the European theatre.
Well, it was so far away. It was the forgotten war. I mean, we got what was not wanted anywhere else, and very little of it, too, that could be spared from the east, from the west. Came east. That's why we were flying Hurricanes when people were flying Typhoons in Europe. Typhoons were like Hurricanes. We like Thunderbolts. We didn't get Thunderbolts until 1945. By that time, they were outmoded in Europe, even.
And how about the conditions for the troops? And you know yourself what you experienced in Burma.
Well,
these very dire, did you think? You know, I mean, one hears, did you ever have beer or any luxuries?
Until 1945, none of those luxuries came through. In 1945, round about March, April, we began to see cigarettes, free cigarettes, free beer, and the odd bottle of scotch. This was all welfare stuff, and how much we got waylaid on en route back at base, I don't know. But we did, when we were lucky, get most months got our free ration of beer and cigarettes. I think that's all I can say about that.
If you have any thoughts about the sort of, there's a great deal of coverage about World War II, isn't there? Always,
yes,
on radio, television, and particularly literature. Is as much attention paid to the Far East, do you think, Burma and India, as perhaps the European theatre?
Oh, very definitely. I mean, after all, Britain was fighting for its life. And we were one of the tentacles very, very far out. And the priority went to anything to do with Britain and Europe. And, of course, North Africa, where we defeated the Germans. And the war then switched to Italy. The priorities, no doubt about it, were the Atlantic anti-submarine warfare and the European war. What was left came out. It was important, and they did the best they could. They sent us what they could, but we were at the end of the line, and we got what you always get at the end of the line, not very much. But having said that, we had nothing to compare things with. We were jolly glad to get what we got. So we didn't feel that we were being deprived. We thought we were jolly lucky to get it. I don't think, as far as my own experience was concerned, if we had something to fly, it didn't matter if it was made of canvas and bamboo. That was fine by us.
Yes, I suppose you wouldn't have been aware of a comparison.
Not really. This dawned on us very late. When all the good stuff started coming through, my goodness, what we've missed.